Hello, this is Judy, and for the next hour, I will be reading selected articles from the Toronto Star edition of November 24th, 2025, on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. I will do my best to pronounce all names and words, yet please excuse me if I do not. And the first article we are reading is in the business section, and it's an opinion. And the title is While an Erratic Trump Ignores Canada, Carney Quietly Cements International Investments, Elbows Up, Indeed. And then there's a picture of Prime Minister Mark Carney's Canada, that U.S. President Donald Trump finally confronts at trade talks, writes David Olub. We'll have more powerful friends around the world. And this photograph is taken by Jim Watson, and that's the AFP via Getty Images file photo. And this article is written by David Olub, Star Business columnist. So, what happened to the elbows up defiance of the U.S. that Mark Carney promised? It's been about 10 months since U.S. President Donald Trump declared economic war on Canada, and there have been no progress in ending the debacle. That failure is not Canada's fault. Trump is playing another of his games with us, this time giving us the silent treatment. Another factor is that Canada barely registers among Trump's foreign policy priorities. Topping the list are China and Ukraine. China has imposed retaliatory tariffs on the U.S. and cut it off from everything from critical minerals to advanced semiconductors. And in Ukraine, Trump is intent on winning a Nobel Peace Prize for ending the conflict, fulfilling one of his best-known campaign promises. Finally, the Trump administration is currently keen to scrap the trilateral trade deal among the U.S., Canada, and Mexico. Trump prefers to strike separate trade deals with the two countries. That's time-consuming. The White House is still figuring out what it wants from each country. Then again, the erratic Trump might eventually revert to a renegotiation of the existing trilateral deal, a CUSMA, of which he was very proud of when it was signed in 2018, and enacted in 2020. Trump should be proud of what is called the USMCA in the US. He extracted concessions from Canada and Mexico in the renegotiated North American Free Trade Agreement. USMCA has a, in quote, sunset clause that Trump insisted on. The Trudeau government balked at that, arguing that a treaty with an expiration date is no treaty at all, which is true. But Canada agreed to it rather than lose the CUSMA altogether. And after getting Trump to agree to a CUSMA review every 6 years rather than the 4 years Trump initially demanded. We've since tried placating Trump and learned that he cannot be appeased. Mark Carney, the Prime Minister, has dispensed with our proposed digital sales tax at Trump's behest and has lifted most of the retaliatory tariffs on U.S. goods that only Canada and China dare to impose. Carney has personally apologized to Trump for the Ontario TV ad narrated by Ronald Reagan, who from the grave makes a persuasive case against tariffs that unnerve Trump. And in his latest visit to the White House, Carney publicly lavished Trump with praise for his peacemaking efforts. It was cringeworthy and has yet to manifest in a tangible payoff. Instead, Trump has imposed still more tariffs or higher ones on Canadian-made trucks, lumber, and manufactured wood products like rocking chairs and dining sets made by artisans in Quebec and New Brunswick. Trump justifies his tariffs, illegal in international law and a violation of U.S. treaties on national security grounds. Trump would have Americans believe that Canada-made kitchen cabinets pose a national security threat to the U.S. Carney's concessions have been limited, however. Canada's supply management system in agriculture is not on the table, for instance. Those brandishments Carney must have at least set an amicable tone for the Canada-U.S. trade negotiations when they finally commence. With its refusal to negotiate, the U.S. has forced us to wait Trump out. But that actually works to our advantage. The longer the wait, the stronger Canada's negotiating position will be when Trump is finally ready to talk. Carney inherited from the former Prime Minister Justin Trudeau historic free trade deals with the European Union, EU, and 10 Pacific Rim countries, plus Britain in the Comprehensive and Progressive Agreement for Trans-Pacific Partnership, CPTPP. That agreement is anchored by Japan and Australia. Carney has since struck additional security, defense, and trade deals with the EU and other jurisdictions. Most important, Carney is gradually normalizing relations between Canada and the two immense markets of China and India. Carney has personally inspected the shipyards in South Korea and Germany from which we will purchase submarines, earning more goodwill for Canada. Carney has recently been in the United Arab Emirates to shake the UAE money tree for more offshore investment in his Canadian nation building projects. It will likely be forthcoming because the UAE has profited from investments it already has in Canada. Next stop, the annual G20 summit this year in South Africa, where Carney will talk with heads of sovereign wealth funds and other deep-pocketed foreign investors. The Swedish royal family's recent Canadian visit with the head of defense contractors SAAB in tow has helped cement relations between Canada and Sweden, one of our newest NATO partners. And the latest federal budget provides tens of millions of dollars to build energy and transportation infrastructure and accelerate critical minerals production. And it vastly increases spending on defense preparedness. The Canada that Trump finally confronts at the negotiating table will have more powerful friends around the world, and it will be on track to more ably get its resource wealth to non-U.S. markets to protect its own Arctic sovereignty and to project military power worldwide. And that is most assuredly elbows up. The next article is GTA, and it's the CPKC holiday train will roll into Toronto this Saturday. Since 1999, the CPKC has raised over 26.1 million and 5.4 million pounds of food, which are donated to local food banks. And there's a picture of the CP holiday train, which will arrive in Toronto on Saturday with Christmas decorations and bright lights. And this article is written by Josh McGinnis, staff reporter. The Canadian Pacific Kansas City holiday train is on track to return to Toronto this Saturday. Returning for its 27th year, the holiday-themed train, there are actually two, runs from November 19th to December 21st, traveling across Canada and the United States in an effort to raise donations for local food banks, according to the CPKC website. The trains are decorated in bright, colorful lights and colored in holiday motifs. On Saturday at 8:30 p.m., one of the holiday trains will stop at 750 Runnymede Road, which is just south of St. Clair Avenue West. Musicians Jade Eagleson and Tegan Gaze, G-A-Y-S-E, are set to perform at the event. Admission is free, but CPKC asks that the attendees bring donations for local food bank. Since 1999, the CPKC holiday train has raised more than $26.1 million and 5.4 million pounds of food for North American food banks, and all donations raised at each stop remain in the community where they are donated. The trains make stops all across North America, hitting cities such as Vancouver, Montreal, Kansas City, and more. And then there's a clarification at the bottom on November 24th, 2025. This article was updated from our previous version to make clear that the holiday train will stop at the Junction Rail Yard in Toronto at 750 Runnymede, that's R-U-N-N-Y-M-E-D-E Road, on Saturday, November 29th at 8:30 p.m. This article is in the business section, and the title is Buy Yourself the Damn Diamond, How Mejuri, M-E-J-U-R-I, co-founder and CEO, changed the way you buy bling. A decade ago, Noura, N-O-U-R-A, Sajika, S-A-K-K-I-J-H-A, wanted to, in quotes, make fine jewelry accessible. Since then, Mejuri has fulfilled 7 million orders online and through its 56 stores, Canada, the US, Australia, and London. And there's a picture of, it's of the CEO, Noura Sajuki, and it's a picture of her, and the caption reads, jewelry is, in quotes, typically marketed for men to buy for women. We wanted to create a brand that is anchored in self-purchase. And this article is written by Jared Lindzone, L-I-N-D-Z-O-N, special to the star. In an industry built around male gift givers, Noura Sajuka has changed the focus to the wearer. The Mejuri co-founder and CEO's jewelry shops and online store now resonate with millions of women, including some of the world's most powerful. In quotes, it's typically marketed for men to buy for women, says a third-generation jewelry maker whose last name is synonymous with fine jewelry in her native Jordan. We wanted to create a brand that is anchored on self-purchase. Buy yourself that the damn diamond. After earning a degree in industrial engineering from the University of Jordan, Sajuki followed her brother to Toronto in 2008, where she pursued a part-time MBA at the Ted Rogers School of Management while working at CIBC. During her studies, she met her future husband and business partner, Majed, M-A-J-E-D, with whom she collaborated on a business plan for a company that crowdsourced jewelry designs. The idea earned top prize at TMU's Slate New Venture Competition, along with $25,000 in seed funding. But she says after graduating and leaving CIBC to work on it full-time from 2013 to 2014, they found the crowdsourcing idea unsustainable as it lacked a cohesive brand direction. So they pivoted and relaunched in 2015 as a brand built around the end wearer. At that time, the new businesses were leveraging the direct-to-consumer model to offer lower prices in industries like fashion and cosmetics while using online tools to build awareness. We wanted to reduce the distance between the customer and us, she said. Fine jewelry is highly fragmented, and there was an opportunity for the next generation brand to come and take market share at a global level. In the decade since, Mejuri has fulfilled more than 7 million orders online and through its 56 brick-and-mortar stores in Canada, the U.S., Australia, and London. The company employs 700 staff around the world and has had more than 3 million customers, including Meghan Markle, Oprah, Kate Middleton, Selena Gomez, and Taylor Swift. The star caught up with her at the Mejuri head office in Toronto ahead of its annual Black Friday sale to talk about the company's founding mission, its efforts to hold the industry to a higher standard, and how skyrocketing gold prices are dictating this season's jewelry trends. Question, did you always want to be an entrepreneur? Answer, growing up, everybody around me was an entrepreneur, even my cousins, so it kind of felt natural. I always dreamed of doing something big. I loved the idea of having a factory and the idea of making things, even as a kid. Question, is that why you studied industrial engineering? Answer, I've always loved math. I've always loved science. I love art too, but I'm not good at it. So engineering made a lot of sense. My brother, Masoud, M-A-S-O-U-D, studied engineering and I followed in his footsteps, but did industrial engineering because it sits closer to business. Question, why did you move to Canada in 2008? Answer: I've always wanted global experience, and my brother was living here, so I thought I'd go somewhere where I have family. I came to Canada to do my MBA, and the idea was to go back after that. But then I met my husband and business partner, Mahad, and decided to stay. Question: How did Mejuri, and it's spelled Mejuri, come about? Mahad and I created a business plan for an early vision of Mejuri as part of a school project. After graduation, I pitched it at the Slate New Venture Competition and won the top prize of $25,000 in seed funding. I replaced the part-time MBA with working on Mejuri part-time while working full-time as a consultant to CIBC's process engineering department. At that point, the company was based on crowdsourcing. We wanted to empower designers from all over the world, but when we started working on it seriously in 2013, we realized it didn't work. Why not? Because there was no creative direction. I loved the idea of creating a brand, and that takes a lot of consistency. So in 2014, I quit my job and we pivoted the whole idea. Instead of empowering designers, we built a brand for women to buy jewelry for themselves, where we could control the experience from end to end and ensure quality production. We then relaunched Mejuri in 2015. Question: What inspired the new direction? Answer: Direct-to-consumer brands, or what I call, in quotes, next generation brands, were popping up in every vertical, like fashion, leather, goods, and cosmetics, but there was nothing in jewelry. If you wanted to buy jewelry, it was either super high-end or costume jewelry, but not much in between. There were some smaller designers, but few major brands. In 2014, McKinsey valued the industry at about $200 billion and projected it would grow to over $400 billion by the year 2020. But only 20% of fine jewelry sales were branded products, compared to 60% of watches. So there was an opportunity for a well-branded next-generation jewelry business to take market share. It was a moment of, in quotes, how can we make fine jewelry accessible? I know for my family's business, it's typically marketed for men to buy for women. It's typically a high price point that requires specific purchasing power to access, and you typically put it in a box and wear it on occasion. We wanted to create a brand that is anchored on self-purchase. In quotes, buy yourself the damn diamond, as we say. That changes how you think about design, about go-to-market, and how you connect with customers. For example, we introduce new products every Monday, whereas for most brands, it's twice or four times a year. We don't have glass display cases because we want people to feel welcome and we want them to be able to touch the products. We don't do wholesale. We go direct to consumers through our stores and website so we can offer more affordable prices without cutting corners on materials, design, or manufacturing. Many of our stores offer piercing so customers can get pierced with the product they want rather than waiting for it to heal first. Those are just a few components we brought to the industry that are fresh and modern. What does Mejuri mean? Mejuri. It doesn't mean anything. I wish there was a better story, but we made it up. We wanted something that didn't have meaning yet so that we could create meaning ourselves. Question: Lots of celebrities wear Mejuri. Do any stand out? Early in our journey, Oprah was in for an ad for a different brand wearing our hoops with pearls earrings, and that ended up being on a billboard in Times Square. So that was a big moment for us. And then, of course, Taylor Swift. She wears our heirloom ring and red garnet, which is very meaningful for her, and she keeps wearing it, which tells you that she really loves it. Amy Lou Wood was wearing our JoJo double hoots this summer while promoting White Lotus. We normally don't collaborate directly with celebrities, but we recently partnered with tennis star Emma Navarro, Navarro, who wears our products both on and off the court, which really demonstrates how fine jewelry can be every day, not just for special occasions. Question: How does it feel to see the world's most powerful women wearing your products? Answer: It just confirms that what we're doing is resonating with the amazing woman. We're all about female empowerment, and these powerful women could have worn super high-end products, but they've chosen Mejuri. Frankly, I think it also makes them more relatable. Question. The jewelry industry has a spotted record on ethical sourcing and sustainability. How are you addressing that? We have only worked with Responsible Jewelry Council certified manufacturers from the start, but as the company grew, we've been able to do more. For example, we're using certified recycled gold and silver to offset our carbon emissions, and we have a goal to improve our material traceability to ensure ethical sourcing. We also made a $1.5 million U.S. in U.S. money investment in a company called Regeneration, which goes to old orphan mines in Canada and Alaska and uses innovative techniques to essentially mine gold while restoring the surrounding natural habitat. Because of that, we are the first and only fine jewelry brand to offer something called Salmon Gold, which helps restore former fish habitats through the mining process. It's something I'm really proud of because it feels like, as a 10-year-old company, we're doing things much bigger companies would do. Question, what are the big trends in jewelry now? Answer, the price of gold is dictating trends right now. The commodity has doubled in the past 2 years, so there's a lot of demand for daintier pieces. We introduced 10 karat gold, recognizing that 14 carats may now be cost prohibitive for certain styles. We also work with gold vermeil, V-E-R-M-E-I-L, which is a sterling silver plated in 18 karat gold. That has been impacted by the price of gold, but it was already popular because you get an amazing look that's not as expensive. Customers are also realizing that gold is an investment, so it's still popular, but we're seeing greater appetite for alternatives. Our philosophy is that no matter the metal, we're obsessed with design and quality at good prices. We want our customers to feel special, whether they're wearing a $50 product or a $10,000 product. Question, where do you hope to take Mejuri from here? Answer, I feel like we're just getting started. Mejuri can be a global brand. There have been a ton of amazing international jewelry companies that have proven what's possible. We're expanding heavily in North America, but I think there is potential for us on a global level. Jared Lindzen is a Toronto-based freelance journalist, public speaker, and contributor for the Star's business section. You are listening to a reading of selected articles and features from the Toronto Star on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Our next article is Toronto the Better section. It's an opinion. Let's fix it. Toronto has more underused parking lots than you'd think. Here's how to use them better. And there's a picture of an entrance to an underground parking garage. And it's the caption reads, parking spaces in Toronto are nowhere near as scarce as once imagined, according to new data. And the picture is taken by Steve Russell, Toronto Star. And this article is written by Sean Mellecalf, M-I-C-A-L-L-E-F. He's a contributing columnist. This is one of the series of columns in the Star that highlights important places in Toronto that could do with fixing up and suggests ways they could be improved, from quick fixes to pie-in-the-sky ideas to make them great. There's an anachronist, A-N-A-C-H-R-O-N-I-S-T-I-C, 19-space parking lot at Danforth and Plyter, P-L-A-Y-T-E-R Boulevard. On a great retail strip with a 60-year-old subway, it's more small town than big city. Municipally owned and run by the Toronto Parking Authority, TPA, this lot was even overhauled a few years ago with permeable pavement and stone boulders around the edges. The renovation and municipal ownership is a sign parking still drives, no pun intended, a lot of local politics and planning. We always need more parking, it seems. Perception is everything, though. On city streets, if parking is not in front of a destination, it will seem too far away for many. Yet at the mall, much greater distances between parking spots and destination will be walked without hesitation. The perception that Toronto parking is scarce was recently shattered by data released by the TPA. As reported by Matt Elliott in his newsletter, City Hall Watcher, there are far more empty spots than we might imagine. The 21 least used off-street lots in the second quarter of 2025 ranged from just 3% to 29% average daily peak occupancy. That's a lot of empty space. When bike lanes were put up on the Esplanade, Esplanade, there was worry about loss of parking spots. But data also shows that the nearby municipal garage created at great expense underneath the new North St. Lawrence Market building is also nearly empty. Great expense has been spent on required parking in the new developments across the city, though Toronto has loosened up in recent years, even allowing buildings with no parking to be built. Other garages in newer old residential buildings across the city are not full. There's space, yet the politics of parking continues. Currently, a proposal to build housing on municipal parking lot at Eggleton Avenue and Dufferin, Dufferin Street, has neighbors objecting, and a few years ago in East York, some neighbors claimed a parking lot set to be modular housing was the heart and hub of community. Toronto has been lucky that development has filled in most parking lots around the older parts of the city, created in the mid-century when cities across North America destroyed themselves in order to make space for cars. It was one of the most self-defeating moves in urban history. Toronto's market has been so hot that it has made financial sense to bury parking below grade. In many North American cities, their downtowns are full of buildings sitting on multiple-story podiums of parking space, creating a strange, hollow-feeling city. We could do better, though, and give Toronto parking lots better uses. Quick fixes. Parking lots are visible blights and social dead spaces, but the plaza pops, and it's PLAZA, and then in all caps, POPS projects, has demonstrated transformations can be done quickly and easily. Installing temporary seating tables and landscaping in strip mall lots across Toronto over the past few years, the project created people places where there was just asphalt, once just asphalt. Think curbside cafe too, patios, but in parking lots. Portions of municipal lots across the city could be given over to local community groups to create their own small plazas. Toronto loves a street festival, so why not keep some of that vitality all year long? How about winter markets? Serious changes. Toronto has been making serious changes under Mayor Olivia Chow and through CREATE-TO, the city's real estate agency, but local residents and businesses often object. We should have an even more aggressive policy to turn away as many municipal lots as possible into needed housing, as affordable as possible, and to bury a smaller, more efficient amount of parking. We have the underused land. Let's build. Market and funding mechanisms need to align, but a major shift in the city priorities would help. At council this week, Chow successfully moved to dissolve the TPA board and conduct a governance review so more change may be yet on the horizon. In busy places, some municipal lots should become permanent European or Latin American style piazzas where people can meet and hang out with having to buy something. Imagine that lot at Danforth and Plater as a piazza to match Alexander the Great Parkette a few blocks east. The current city is currently turning a large Liberty Village parking lot into a needed park, so it's all quite possible. If private property could transform this way, the vast parking lot in front of the Metro on College Street in Little Italy could finally give it that neighborhood the Napoli or Palermo-worthy piazza it deserves. Pie in the sky. When I lived in a mid-century apartment building, a room in the underused basement garage became a practice space for a band. As surprising as it was to hear pop, plunk, echoing when going to the car. In a city with a crisis of art space availability, it seemed ingenious and reminiscent of how artists inhabited rough, unrenovated lofts and old industrial spaces. Not for everyone, and ventilation and other issues would need to be sorted, but arts and culture need rough, creative spaces, and garages have them. This next article is in sports, and it's about the Raptors, and it is an opinion. The title is, Toronto sports fans are getting Blue Jays vibes from the energized Raptors. The Maple Leafs must have missed the memo. And there's a picture, it's a basketball team, and it's with Raptors sophomore Jacoby Walter celebrates a three-pointer in Sunday's win over the Brooklyn Nets at Scotiabank Arena. And the photograph is by Steve Russell of the Toronto Star. And this article is written by Dave Feschnick, FESCHUK sports columnist. A little more than a month ago, shortly after George Springer's three-run dinger launched the Blue Jays into an improbable World Series, no one was thinking about the Raptors. But Raptors coach Darko Rajovic, Rajakovic, was bold enough to think about what it would be like to be the Blue Jays. In quotes, "It's awesome for us to be in the city and to see that energy," Rajovic said in the midst of that fairy tale October. "That type of energy is going to be the same for us once we start rolling in the playoffs." At that time, of course, it seemed harmlessly quaint to view the Raptors as playoff locks. Odds makers had them as something less than that. When Rajovic spoke those words, his team, coming off a 30-win season, had yet to play a game. But a little more than a month later, the Red Hot Raptors are proving their coach prophetic by making an early case as heirs to the Jays' legacy, a likable team defying low expectations to make an unlikely run. That's not to pretend the Raptors have accomplished anything of substance. The Jays came within a toenail of a championship. What we've seen so far from Toronto's NBA team amounts to little more than seedlings of a promising season. What we've seen so far, mind you, has been compelling. The Raptors, like the Jays, make defense a priority. The Raptors, like the Jays, don't seem to mind making the occasional sacrifice for the collective good. Newcomer Brandon Ingram, the team's leading scorer, isn't shooting quite as often as he's been accustomed to in recent seasons, yet he still looks engaged on the defensive end. Ditto Scotty Barnes and RJ Barrett and Emmanuel Quickley. This team is playing hard and playing together. And maybe, equally important, they seem to enjoy playing together. That last part is never a given in pro sports. So far, so good. It's hard to get the same feeling watching the joyless slog that's been the shambles of a Maple Leaf season, which in some ways seems like an unlikely role reversal. The optimistic spin after last season was that the Leafs, buoyed by coming within a game of dethroning the defending Stanley Cup champions from Florida in a postseason second round, which would come back stronger. Sure, they lost a significant star with Mitch Marner's exit to Las Vegas, but Marner was a divisive presence whose career playoff stats in big games were abysmal. The Whiteley and Spouse management brainwaves was that the Leafs would prove a more formidable force in the postseason with the right collection of replacements taking up Marner's salary cap space. There's still enough time for that to prove to be true, but you've got to make the playoffs to win in the playoffs. And the Leafs, losers of seven of their past eight games, woke up Sunday dead last in the Eastern Conference. MoneyPuck.com pegged their probability of making the playoffs at 6.8%, worse than their 8.3% chance of landing the first overall pick in the draft lottery. If those numbers seem unreasonably grim, given Toronto's recent run of tough injury luck and the 60 games remaining, most betting markets were kinder. One popular sports book had the Leafs as plus 135 underdogs to make the playoffs, an implied probability of 43%. Whatever your preferred math, here's the truth. The only NHL team to make the playoffs in each of the past 9 seasons is a long way from a sure thing from running that streak to 10. Even if they sneak in, it won't be easy to frame the Leafs as lovable underdogs. What's to like about these Leafs? The core of a team that went and played for a Stanley Cup winning coach named Mike Babcock looks like it has little interest in playing for a Stanley Cup winning coach named Craig Berube, Berube. To suggest coaching is the only problem is to bury one's head in the sand at 9+ seasons of evidence otherwise. The Raptors were supposed to be the team with the unproven coach. Radovanovic's reputation as a developer of talent hardly guaranteed he knew how to win games. And the Raptors, too, attracted plenty of preseason skepticism. They were the oddly constructed luxury tax team that hadn't made the playoffs since 2021. They were the protracted roster rebuild that left championship-winning team presidents Masai Ujiri, Ujiri, vulnerable to boardroom attack. Ujiri, fired in the offseason, would probably say he's not surprised that the Raptors went into Sunday's game against the Brooklyn Nets on pace to win 56 games this season, even though they won 55 in the past 2 seasons combined. The rest of us were never so sure. As it is, the Raptors are a team with low expectations, emerging as a pleasant surprise that's easy to get behind. Their early vibes are Blue Jays-esque. And the lifeless, luckless Leafs, theirs are the antithesis. The next article is in the Canada section, and the title is Ottawa announces $35 million for 30 oral health training programs across Canada. Montreal, the federal government has announced more than $35 million over 3 years to train dental students across the country. And this article is by Miriam LaFontaine, and that's LaFontaine of the Canadian Press. Montreal, the federal government has announced more than $35 million over 3 years to train dental students across the country. Health Minister Marjorie Michel made the announcement today in Montreal with Carlos Leitao, L-E-I-T-A-O, Liberal MP and former Quebec Finance Minister. A news release says the funding will go towards 30 oral health programs, mainly at universities and colleges, for future dentists and dental hygienists. Michael says the money will fill competency gaps to ensure more Canadians can access dental care. As well, the minister says close to 6 million people have been approved for care under the federal government's dental care plan. Ottawa launched the plan in for children and seniors in May 2024 and expanded it last May to cover people of all ages with household incomes under $90,000 and no private insurance. This report by the Canadian Press was first published November 24, 2025. This next article is titled, Here's How Unions That Back Doug Ford Scored on Funding Applications. Almost half of the 17 unions that endorsed Premier Doug Ford for re-election got nearly $40 million from the controversial Skills Development Fund despite low-ranked applications, according to secret data obtained by The Star. And there's a picture of many people, and in the middle, it's Labor Minister Piccini, P-I-C-C-I-N-I, speaks to reporters at Queen's Park on October 20th, 2025. And the photograph, the picture is taken by Laura Proctor of the Canadian Press. And this article is written by Maura Welsh of the Queen's Park Bureau and Rob Ferguson of the Queen's Park Bureau. Almost half of the 17 unions that endorsed Premier Doug Ford for re-election got nearly $40 million from the controversial Skills Development Fund despite low-ranked applications, according to secret data obtained by The Star. 8 labor groups whose leaders backed Ford in Tory campaign posts last winter got at least 14 payments from the $2.5 billion fund. The data provides a snapshot of funding approvals made by Labor Minister Dave Piccini in the first quarters of this year and last year. Pacini had refused to release the rankings of any recipients, including the low-rated request he approved, despite a highly critical October 1st Auditor General's report that said some of those decisions go against, in quote, stated program objectives, such as workforce resilience, innovative training, and support for, in quotes, underrepresented groups. Some of the organizations that supported the premier and also had successful applications received high scores. Merit Open Shop, a non-union group that endorsed Ford, had two applications with high ranking scores of 84 and 76 in the database funding period. Other labor groups, such as the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers and its various locals, had scores ranging from a high of 82 to a low of 35. But the data highlights the enthusiasm of the progressive conservative government in cases where it doled out millions of public dollars. Let me rephrase it again. Doled out millions of public dollars despite warnings from staff. Puccini's office defended its approval of low-scoring groups. In quotes, as we have repeatedly stated to you, all Skills Development Fund projects go through a rigorous competitive evaluation process with clear guidelines, a spokesperson said Friday. In the database, the minister's, in quotes, rationale column shows that Puccini consistently overruled civil servants' concerns about questionable use of the money, such as duplicate funding from other government programs or extraordinary high administration costs. The greatest beneficiary among unions endorsing Ford was the Carpenters District Council of Ontario. In the two funding periods examined, it was awarded $19.5 million, despite evaluations deemed low, 34 to 62 out of 100, by ministry standards. That includes $14 million in early 2025, $14 million in early 2025, based on a score of 50%, previously reported in the Star. A year earlier, civil servants gave the Carpenters Council application a score of 57% for its $5.5 million request. Under the database heading, quote, application risk, a bureaucrat noticed concerns with the plan to train 500 workers on, in quotes, job readiness and on-the-job training over 8 weeks and a separate week of skills upgrading for 250 late-term apprentices. Puccini personally signed off on the low-ranked application, since a minister's approval is required for $5 million or more. The council did not respond to a request for comment. In the legislature's daily question period, opposition MPPs have been hammering Puccini over his decision to fund low-rated proposals, growing increasingly frustrated with a minister practiced in deflection. But last Tuesday, instead of listing the names of trainees he said were grateful for the fund, Puccini went on the defense, offering up his top bureaucrat as an official with the power to overrule a minister's decision. The deputy minister is able to deselect an applicant if they feel the risk of a project is too high, Puccini said. So now it's the deputy minister's fault, New Democrat leader Merit Stiles shouted across the aisle. Claiming Puccini was hiding behind an independent civil service, Stiles continued her attack the next day. Up until now, Stiles observed, he has stood in his chamber and he has justified hand-picking low-scoring applicants to that fund because they met his government's so-called priorities. Puccini offered an application. Our ministry officials play a crucial role in safeguarding the integrity of the Skills Development Fund. Together, we built strong backstops. Being responsible for applicant approvals, which I am, is not in contradiction with having important stopgaps in place. It highlights the robust internal risk assessment processes we have for this program. Concerns about political decisions were cited in the Auditor General's report released last month. Among the applicants Shelley Spence's scrutinized, more than half submitted applications that were ranked medium, 63 to 72, or lower, and still received $742 million. Spence said 640 applicants with high rankings, 73 to 100, got nothing. There was a mix-up there was a mix of scores among the pro-4 labor groups. The Laborers International Union of North America, it's UNA, all capitalized, had a high of 78% for one proposal and 3 scores in the low category. La UNA said it is not privy to the minister's internal evaluation guidelines and defended the fund for measurable results and worker training over abstract scoring. The Hospitality Workers Union, Unite Here, scored high. So did the Ontario General Contractors Association. The Ontario Masonry Training Center received a high and low ranking for its applications. Tony D. Maria, president of the Training Center's partner, the Brick and Allied Craft Union of Canada, said he didn't know why the 2024 score was low, but said it might have been related to fewer apprenticing opportunities. We follow the economy and sometimes we get a lot of work, but there are times when the jobs aren't ready until next year, Di Maria said. The ministry spokesperson said union applications got approved because they are, in quotes, among the most effective training providers for skilled workers, provide safety training, and help women, newcomers, and marginalized workers enter the trades. 3 locals with the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers had low scores, but got a total of $3.63 million. One had an application score of 62 and received $1.425 million. Another was rated 56 and received $1.195 million. A third, Local 353 in Toronto, was ranked at 35% and awarded $1.01 million. Ministry staff said the request for money would better fit a different government program and noted that the, in quotes, administrative costs are 80% of the operational costs, exceeding the ministry's maximum of 15%. Local 353 did not respond to a request for comment. The, in quotes, minister's rationale for its approved of the 35% application did not mention the risk. In quotes, project is innovative, it said, and supports an in-demand trade sector in a community in need. This next article is titled, A Viral Facebook Post Claimed There Was a New Vaccine for Peanut Allergies, How to Spot Hyper-Realistic Health Misinformation. AI misinformation can be particularly harmful when it comes to health and medicine. And there's a picture of all this peanut butter. And it said, this month, 4 food allergy researchers from McMaster released a statement confirming that the Facebook post incorrectly suggested a vaccine was developed at the school. And this photo was taken by Michelle Mengsu Chang, and that's MENGSUCHANG, and it's a Toronto Star file folder. This article is written by Sadine Moshen, MOHSEN, staff reporter. When Kristen Myers read that a vaccine for peanut allergies was available, she thought it would mean freedom for her 7-year-old daughter, Haley. Quote, she has other disabilities that she struggles with, and this was just one thing on the list, Myers said. I was like, maybe we're going to be able to say this is no longer a problem. But the Facebook post claiming the vaccine existed turned out to be AI spreading false information, one that has garnered thousands of likes, shares, and comments filled with relief. The Facebook group, which describes itself as a, in quotes, media news company, has a slew of other similar looking posts featuring AI generated images. Quotes, people once terrified by microscopic traces of peanuts can now enjoy food freely, even eating peanut butter again without fear, the post reads, after claiming a clinical trial of 120 patients took place where 89% of participants developed full tolerance after 3 months of treatment at McMaster University. The publication the post cites also does not exist. AI misinformation has spread around the internet, but can be particularly harmful when it comes to health and medicine, creating false hope or leading to dangerous practices. It can be difficult to spot, but but experts have some suggestions for how to avoid falling into its traps. For Myers, who lives in Calgary, the realization was, in quotes, devastating. Her daughter relies on an EpiPen if she's exposed to peanuts and has been to the hospital several times. This purported vaccine would have been life-changing for her. In quotes, we should have known this was too good to be true. Here's what you need to know about AI-generated medical misinformation and how to catch it. Question, how did AI misinformation become so prevalent? Dr. Alan Vaisman, Vaisman, an infection control and infectious disease physician at the University Health Network, said the recent loss of trust in medical institutions, in quotes, leaves a gap open for people to get information from other, possibly unreliable sources. There are many vaccine-preventable infections that can cause a lot of harm if people start to fall prey to the disinformation in the campaigns using AI, he said. The more false information spreads around the internet, the harder it will become for people to fact-check, Vaisman believes, pointing to Google AI overviews as an example. Quotes, it feeds off various other social media platforms, various other posts, he said. If there's enough disinformation out there, there's going to be more doubt cast upon value. Over 47% of Canadians have tried AI tools for work, school, or personal reasons, according to a Ledger report earlier this year, up from 25% in 2023. In spaces where vaccines are a controversial topic, in quotes, bad actors will intentionally use AI and bots to amplify false information, said Matthew Miller, director of the DeGroote Institute for Infectious Disease Research at McMaster University. In quotes, it's intentionally weaponized and can be really dangerous because it can be amplified in large circles very, very quickly, he said. Question, why is AI so hard to spot? Answer, Clifton van der Linden, director of the Digital Society Lab at McMaster, said people don't take the extra time to find the sources of an AI post, nor are they naturally exposed to the, in quotes, factual claim that refutes the original false post. Sometimes people also purposely turn to AI to summarize and explain complicated medical research. There's a danger to using artificial intelligence in this way, van der Linden said. It will not always provide an accurate representation or summary of the work that it is investigating. It's also unreasonable to expect people to have the time or training to assess the scientific information that they're reading and determine whether or not it's factual, he said. This is a difficult burden to download to the mass public who are already overburdened. And then there's a post, it's a picture of what the actual post, and the post says, no more EpiPens, no more panic. Canada's peanut allergy vaccine reprograms immunity in 4 doses, changing millions of lives. And that's the AI post, the inaccurate AI post that claimed that. Question, how can we identify misinformation? Once misinformation is out there, it is extremely hard to correct, Miller said. A way to prevent people from falling prey to the spread of false information is the pre-bunking, warning people in advance about news they could encounter. Context is everything, Miller said. It's something that we can't just rely on AI for. AI-generated text generally lacks personal opinions and has a dry robotic tone, according to the federal government's website through its Get Cyber Safe awareness campaign. Some AI tools are trained on old data, giving false information about current events, the website reads, urging Canadians to fact check what they read, if it seems exaggerated or coming from fake sources. Images generated by AI usually have smooth, crisp images with heavily blurred backgrounds, and people tend to appear glossy or unusually smooth skin or clothing, according to the website. The Facebook page that claimed the vaccine for peanut allergies existed has these types of images. These images can also feature incorrect shadows and lighting or text within the images that don't form real words or letters. Videos generated by AI typically have inconsistent lighting, people who don't blink, and irregular audio with the unnatural tones and choppy sentences. The Canadian government website also says not to rely on AI detection tools because, in quotes, they are often unreliable. So, is there a vaccine for peanut allergies? Early in November, four food allergy researchers from McMaster University released a statement confirming that the Post incorrectly suggested a vaccine was developed at the school. Generative AI may be mixing up our long history of advancing allergy research with other publicly available scientific concepts, the statement said. Susan Wasserman, one of the co-authors of the statement, said she wasn't aware of the Facebook post until Food Allergy Canada contacted the university about the vaccine claim. Postings such as the AI-generated post overshadow legitimate food allergy-related research, Wasserman said. Her colleagues also had not heard about the story. In quotes, if there was a major discovery, we all would have been aware of it. And Sadine Mohsen, M-O-H-S-E-N, is a staff reporter with the Star, Toronto Star. She can be reached at S-A-M-O-H-S-E-N at symbol thestar.ca. And you've been listening to a reading of featured articles from the Toronto Star on November 24, 2025 for the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Your reader has been Judy, and I thank you for listening. Have a great day, take care of yourselves, and thank you so much for sharing some of your time with me.